Hello, once again, welcome to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Drayhawk.
And I'm your co-host, Jack Sniflin.
Thank you for joining us for episode 31, the finals of our Disney bracket.
Ooh!
So we may have some new listeners who have just skipped the end. What we have done is we compiled a list of the 32 top grossing Disney films based on adjusted gross box office and seeded them into a bracket and went through and watched every single one of them, many of them multiple times, to determine which is the best Disney film, at least by our standards. This has been a roughly 6 month long project. Yeah. We started back in April and is now November. This week, we are down to our final two films. We have 2016's Moana, as well as 2010's Tangled.
Because this is our final episode, we have a few other things we want to finish up. What's the worst film on this bracket? What are some of the contenders first?
Obviously, 2009's Christmas Carol, starring Jim Carrey.
With some truly horrific CGI.
Nightmare-inducing is a term I would use.
There's Peter Pan.
Peter Pan definitely wins for most racist film on our bracket.
I mean, yeah.
Which is impressive, beating out Pocahontas.
Mm-hmm. I'm also going to put forward Bambi, I think.
Bambi is very much a kind of nothing film.
It's very pretty. And Big Joel had a good video on what Bambi's trying to do. And I think we're evaluating it on a very different level.
I think Bambi may be the only film Disney has ever produced where the direct-to-video sequel was better than it.
Cinderella 3, but yes.
Fair enough.
I can safely say that Chicken Little is better than all of those.
Yeah. I'm not sure Pinocchio is, though. Pinocchio is around Bambi levels of,
yeah. It's got a whale in it. Bambi doesn't have a whale in it. Although I think Peter Pan is better than Pinocchio because Peter Pan does have a plot.
That's very true. Do we want to judge these films on how much we hate them? On how well they function as actual films? How watchable they are?
Let's go with how watchable. That's an important quality for a film, that you can watch it.
Yeah. Yes.
Which is why I'm going to put Peter Pan as the worst film in our bracket, because Bambi is pretty bad, but you could put it on, like, in the background, and it's like, oh, there's pretty images happening, that's nice. Christmas Carol, oh boy. But if you have a bunch of friends and you're all, like, hammered already, that could be fun. Peter Pan doesn't really have either of those qualities, and then it has all the other stuff.
With those criteria, I would definitely agree. I definitely think that Peter Pan is the worst film on this bracket. Yeah. Which is sad, because I know Peter Pan is a beloved character, and there are lots of good things with Peter Pan in it, like Hook.
Mm-hmm. Three more.
I honestly can't think of them.
I'll put Christmas Carol forward as the highest gap between potential and achievement.
Yes.
Because, like, films from, like, the Peter Pan and Bambi era, there is many ways in which they just can't age well. Christmas Carol was made 1 year before Tangled.
Image Movers does not have that good of a record.
Right.
So I'm not surprised. But it's also the fact that it falls so far short of so many other good adaptations of that story. Right. It's not Image Movers like, oh, this is a relatively original idea that we are failing at adapting.
Mm-hmm.
No, this has been successfully done time and time again.
Before this.
And we still screwed up really badly.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need a 15-minute spectral ghost chase through the streets of London with a 3-inch Jim Carrey Ebenezer Scrooge. Whoever thought that was a good idea, I hope they were fired very soon after they had that idea.
And with that out of the way, we can probably get to the opposite end of the spectrum. What is the best film of Disney?
Where do we want to start?
It's a kind of minor thing, but when Maui's in the shark head form, the tattoo on his belly has him as a shark head.
That is very nice. There's a lot of little touches that I noticed this time around in Moana. Like, the grandmother's eye roll during the first time the chief is saying no one goes beyond the reef is great. There's also kind of this book-ending line of,
this suits you.
So the first time the chief says it, it's when Moana is doing an excellent job solving the problems that are facing her village. And then the next time that he says it is after Moana has returned, restored the heart, and brought the knowledge of voyaging back to her people.
Also, the lyrics for the song that plays when Maui is relearning how to shapeshift are apparently from a song already existed before the film happened, and it's about two lovers meeting again and remembering how good it felt to dance when they were younger, which is really cool.
That is neat. It is a little weird that it's about two lovers.
Oh, I get where you're coming from. I think this is more with Moana and sailing and then Maui and shapeshifting, not like Moana and Maui.
Yeah.
We probably should talk about this last week because it would be relevant then. But in Leaving the Stitch, we talked about how there are a lot of antagonists and it kind of feels like there's a few too many. Tangled also has a lot of antagonists. You've got the guards, Maximus, Mother Gothel, and the Stabbingtons. But they don't feel like too many. How come? What's different there?
Mostly it's because their goals are lining up much better. Maximus and the guards pretty much have the same goal. It's just that they are separated for a majority of the film, as well as Maximus's character arc changes and moves him to being a protagonist as opposed to an antagonist. And there's also the point where the Stabbingtons and Gothel also converge and they team up to get what they want, and then Gothel backstabs the Stabbingtons.
Who we realize never stab anybody in that movie.
Yeah, literally the only person who stabs someone in that film is Gothel. Whereas in Lilo and Stitch, you've got Jumba, who is trying to do this job so he gains his freedom, while also trying to capture his own creation. Pleakley is trying to babysit him and protect the Mosquito Nature Preserve. Gantu is trying to redeem himself of his failure in letting Stitch escape in the first place, and is also fighting against Jumba and Pleakley to prevent them from doing so as well. You also have all of this stuff going on with Cobra Bubbles. Like, none of it really comes together the same way that Tangled does. So I think that's why the many antagonists work in Tangled as opposed to Lilo and Stitch.
Right. Meanwhile, the antagonists in Moana, namely her dad, Maui, and Teka, are all set up and then cease to become an obstacle at the end of each act, and it's a really good way of showing how Moana is, like, progressing through each phase of her journey.
Yeah, and then you also have, like, Tamatoa there, and the Kakamoro is, like, mini-bosses.
Right.
Bringing up another thing from our episode last week, we talked about Maximus and his character arc and him moving from punitive justice for Eugene to reformative justice. And Moana also has similar themes about challenging the way we think about justice, although in Moana's case, it's much more about restorative justice. So I'm going to define a little vocabulary for people at home. When we're talking about punitive justice, we mean justice that is focused on punishing the offender. You committed a wrong and you should be punished for it. Like, as a kid, timeout is a good example of punitive justice. You are separated off from everyone else and forced to do nothing. And then when we're talking about reformative justice, we're talking about the offender has committed a wrong and there has to be an underlying reason for that. So society is attempting to make it so that the offender realizes what they did was wrong and try to instill in them virtue so they don't do it again and try to make it so that they don't repeat their offense. Community service is a really good example of this sort of reformative justice. Restorative justice is a little bit different in comparison to the others. There's not a lot of good concrete examples in at least our current United States justice system, but restorative justice is more about trying to literally right the wrongs that were committed. Like, when you're a little kid and you got in trouble for hurting someone else, your parents making you go apologize to them, those are kind of along the lines of restorative justice. And that's kind of the whole big arc of Moana, is Moana is trying to get Maui to right the wrong that he committed. And that is more important than the 1,000 years of punishment that Maui's been through of being stuck on that island without his fishhook, unable to leave.
Yeah, those years didn't help, did not achieve anything. He was just sitting there unable to make things better.
Yeah, I just thought it was really interesting how these films, as this sort of the side thing, are challenging our notions of how justice should work.
Both Moana and Tango have the same kind of approach of people becoming better and fixing the problem is better than just some sort of throw them away and lose the door kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Let's just say I put them in a hole and threw away the hole.
What you've seen in other films, like, that's kind of a big thing in the Renaissance era for the villain to be defeated in some way. They're thrown down. Mm-hmm. And I like this evolution towards a more complicated moral framework where people need to do the work to fix the wrong as opposed to just be punished for it.
Mm-hmm.
Although, with Tangled, we see that there's some people who maybe aren't gonna. Mother Gothel doesn't seem like she has a lot of interest in ever reforming.
Tangled might shoot itself in the foot there, but it's also a much smaller theme in Tangled than it respectively is in Moana.
Sure, although I think that there are some people who either restorative justice isn't going to work, or you aren't the right person to do that restorative justice. Mm-hmm. Like, now it wound up not being the right person to replace the heart. It had to be Moana for mm-hmm. whatever reason.
So while we're talking about the evolution of Disney over time, we have both of these characters, Moana and Rapunzel, who are incredibly proactive. They get their own action sequences, are shown to be incredibly competent,
having a variety of skills and positive traits.
They are very much outside of the previous Disney mold of damsel in distress, like Cinderella and Snow White. Then they're much more proactive than even characters like Belle and Jasmine. Not to say that they aren't proactive, but the degree and the way that Rapunzel and Moana are proactive in the plot is different. Mm-hmm. Especially physically proactive.
Yeah.
As opposed to just like mentally and emotionally.
And there's a long, complicated conversation to be had about what kind of proactivity we value and how that's gendered, but we don't need to get into that right now.
Yeah. In that transition from women in Disney being mostly objects to be won, we now, both these films have moved into a different sort of issue where both these films on some level are about women fixing men. We have Rapunzel, who is showing Eugene that just because he grew up poor and an orphan doesn't necessarily have any effect on his inherent worth as a person. And then we have Moana with Maui showing him that his abandonment issues are not his own fault, and that his quest for adoration from mortals has caused harm, and he needs to be more careful and be able to admit when he has done wrongs and rectify them. Unfortunately, this is a really crappy trope in certain respects. This trope has kind of similar features to women in abusive relationships, and very often women in those sorts of relationships feel like it's their duty to repair these men who are actively hurting them and try and turn them into a better person and spend their time and energy trying to fix them when these men aren't willing to put in the effort and energy to fix themselves.
This isn't to say that the men don't have an influence on the women in their narratives. Both Moana and Rapunzel become more self-assured over the course of their films, but their growth, while definitely influenced by the leading men in their narratives, isn't as dramatic. Neither of them go from jerk to hero. They go from sort of heroic to self-actualized heroic.
Effectively, what they gain from their adventures is self-confidence.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not attempting to say that because of the way the relationships between these men and women are portrayed in the film that they're inherently problematic, but it is an issue, and I think that it's probably going to be one that Disney's going to be struggling with for the next little while, because a lot of their other films recently kind of do the same thing.
Like Ralph and Vanellope have that going on.
Mm-hmm.
Frozen's a little bit more complicated because the relationships in there are kind of doing a lot. And again, it's not that story in itself is bad, because there are many real things where a woman makes a man better. It's only a problem if that's the only story we tell. If we're afraid to let women be flawed characters while also still being heroic and a protagonist, then we're failing to tell good stories mm-hmm. overall, even if the individual story is still good. That said, I'm more here for Maui's growth than I am for like Ralph or Shrek, because we're seeing this growth through another person's eyes, so it's not spending an hour or an hour and a half or 2 hours waiting for a flawed character to get over themselves. We're seeing how a good character can help a flawed character become better, and it's a bit less grating. If you, like me, are tired of narratives about shitty menfolk.
Part of it is also that up until the confrontation with Tamatoa, the underlying issues with Maui are much less pronounced. He's kind of just ego-driven as opposed to having baggage that needs to be unpacked. The way Maui is shown kind of before that is more abrasive than outright antagonistic.
Right. Can you talk about how Entangled everybody has hammer space?
You're not wrong. A lot of times the satchel will just kind of appear out of nowhere.
Which I'd understand if the satchel wasn't twice as wide as Rapunzel's waist.
Yeah.
It's not, like, a huge problem. It's not, a plot hole or whatever. It's just, there are times when characters will have or not have things as the plot demands, and I wish they'd put a little bit more thought into where those things were. It might have made the storytelling more interesting.
Yeah. Something in a similar vein to that. I don't get why the ground floor entrance to Rapunzel's tower was blockaded. She had Rapunzel since she was an infant, and her hair was not long enough to climb up. And we see Rapunzel as, like, a small child, probably around the age of 6. And her hair's definitely not long enough to climb up, which means Gothel was still using the ground floor entrance to get up to the tower. Why would she, like, barricade and hide that? Rapunzel already knew about it?
In theory, she might have also just had a rope and pulley system set up to the window, which means she'd be using her own strength, which means that Rapunzel couldn't use it because she'd be not strong enough as an infant, and that probably would have gotten swapped out for the hair over time for, I guess, aesthetic reasons.
To go with the story of Rapunzel, let down your long hair.
Pretty much. It has questions if you dig into it too far. There's also the possibility that maybe the hair... So we saw her in her crib with already pretty long hair, which I think longer than baby's hair is supposed to.
Definitely.
Okay,
definitely
cool.
Longer than
good.
A newborn's hair should be.
Oh, good. I know about newborns. While I agree that that is kind of a weird thing, I can think of a number of ways to work around that that admittedly are a bit of a thing you have to kind of squint at and guess around, but doesn't bother me too much.
Yeah, like, in the grand scheme of things, it's just a, huh, that's weird, as opposed to, this is a massive plot hole.
Right. Also, I just want to talk about the mental image of Mother Gothel in, like, a bucket or a sack, just winching herself up. Maybe like a mortar and pestle or whatever.
You mean like a cauldron?
Yeah.
To finish off the witch aesthetic?
Yeah. Getting super swole.
There's many ways that you can explain it away, but it feels complicated doing it that way.
It feels like at some point they were like, wait, Rapunzel's not in the tower. We gotta get Gothel back into the tower for plot reasons. There's a secret back door now.
Mm-hmm.
Which, fair enough. Gothel does seem... No, she doesn't seem like someone who would intentionally build some sort of back way in.
I don't know.
But then again, the tower's probably already there and probably already have a door. I assume Gothel didn't just, hey, I have this baby. Don't ask questions about why I want a tower that has only one way in and out.
I mean, Gothel's also already hundreds of years old at this point, so...
That might just be her house.
Yeah, I'm assuming that she's lived there for a while.
Speaking of Gothel, do we want to hit that one point?
Yeah, let's go ahead and get into that.
Former guest Daniel pointed out that we hadn't really gotten into this on the podcast, so we're going to make sure we say it.
Yeah. We had talked about it in the past. I'm not sure if those times ended up in the actual podcast or being cut for time.
It might just be that we've talked about the racism in Disney films so much that we've lost track.
But we should point out that Mother Gothel is definitely coded as Jewish, and the way that that is used can definitely be interpreted as anti-Semitic. The curly black hair and the somewhat hooked nose, glowing golden flower, and the greed that Mother Gothel shows towards it.
And these things were worse in concept, so they did pull it back, but not all the way.
There's also cultural stereotypes of the overbearing Jewish mother are definitely apparent with Gothel and the way she treats Rapunzel, even to the point where during Mother Knows Best, there's that very typical New York Jewish mother accent coming through during the song. The coding on Gothel is not great, especially when you juxtapose Gothel next to this blonde, green-eyed paragon of femininity.
We talked about anti-Semitic caricatures in Snow White way back 18,000 years ago. It's not great then. There is a certain amount of, well, it was the 30s. Things were bad back then, but this is made less than 9 years ago.
It's very unfortunate.
It's especially a pity because the complexity of the Mother Gothel-Rapunzel relationship is actually really... And it's unfortunate that it's soured in that particular way that definitely could have been avoided in 2010. Especially since there are so many nose jokes in the film, you think they might have considered what the cultural history of noses are in narrative. That's a weird thing to say.
Moving to a little bit of a lighter topic, we were talking about Mother Knows Best, and I felt so dumb because I only noticed it this watch through, but the entire sequence, Mother Gothel is literally keeping Rapunzel in the dark because she is figuratively keeping Rapunzel in the dark about what the outside world is like.
Yeah.
I just noticed that this watch through. I was watching it with my wife, and she's like, you never got that?
Yeah, there's a scene where Rapunzel's lighting candles, and Gothel's going behind her, snuffing the candles out.
I know. I was paying attention elsewhere. I'm not gonna lie, a lot of time I use the song numbers to write down notes.
That's fair. Tangled has a lot of relatively obvious visual metaphors, and it's not a problem. It's a film for kids, but there are some that are a little bit doofy, and we've talked about this before.
Yeah, we've talked about the mirror, and again, the film uses light quite a bit, and light is definitely used as a metaphor for truth and understanding. We've talked about the difference of how light is used between Rapunzel and the lanterns and how it's very bright and yellow, and then Gothel and the Stabbingtons, where it's much more like sinister and green and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. There's a lot of visual metaphor that you can get into.
Speaking of light while we're here, I know we talked about Moana being really pretty before, but I'll shout out to the sky. It looks good often. That's it. That's my whole shout out.
What's your favorite color?
Cloud.
A thing that I would have loved to see in Moana is when Moana bursts into the village meeting about what to do. All of our crops are dying and blighted.
The crops are turning black. What about the fish?
Moana rushes in with a actual solution, and her father, visibly angry, and kind of ushers her out, grabs a torch, is going to burn the boats. But her father has also spent the last several years establishing Moana as a competent leader that will eventually take over from him. He doesn't have a solution to this problem. Moana does. But due to whatever sort of hang-ups that the chief has, he's unwilling to accept Moana's solution. And I'd love to see the community respond to that, whether sides are chosen or how they deal with that.
Even just maybe a side character saying, now wait a minute, let's hear her out, that kind of thing would have been really nice. It does kind of tie into how Moana seems to subconsciously think of herself as separate from the community. There's a part where we're dealing with the Maui backstory, where she says that,
you took the heart for them. You did everything for them, so they'd love you.
Not, you took the heart for us. She doesn't think of herself as people that Maui takes things for, which is interesting, kind of sad, because Moana clearly loves her people, and I'm sad that she doesn't feel like she's of the people.
That's kind of because she's been sort of faking it. She's been really good at it, but she's like, no, I want to go out there.
I didn't say go beyond the reef because I want to be on the ocean. But you still do.
I want to be on the ocean. I want to be away from this island. Because of the way her dad has reinforced it, the island is the people and is her home. And her wanting to be away from that sets her apart. Once she learns about her culture's history of voyaging, then she can understand, no, the people is not the place.
Asgard is not a place. It's a people.
Like in Thor Ragnarok.
Yeah, there we go.
Taika Waititi did write the original screenplay for this, so...
I can't believe Taika Waititi wrote every movie. Have we talked about how Moana's name means ocean?
She named me after the sea.
Oddly enough, we have not really gotten into, translations and that sort of thing in many of the Disney films we've talked about.
Huh, yeah. It's just kind of a cool thing that I like, that whenever Moana's saying the ocean chose me, she's basically saying she chose herself, which is kind of cool.
At the very beginning of Tangled, we have Eugene narrating the set for the story until we get to present day, a day away from being 18 Rapunzel. And it's interesting in comparison to a lot of other Disney narration.
Oh, you see that old woman over there? You might want to remember her. She's kind of important.
He is narrating the story, but he distinctly has opinions about events and how they unfolded, and his emotions are very apparent as he is narrating, and that's not something that we've often seen in this sort of Disney narrative. We've seen it a couple other times, like in 101 Dalmatians with Pongo's narration.
And Emperor's New Groove.
Mm-hmm. But this is the first time we've seen it in a Disney princess narrative, especially if you compare it to something like Beauty and the Beast. That initial narration is very different.
Once upon a time, in a faraway land, a young prince lived in a shining castle.
That is structured to be like a parent reading a child a story from a book, mm-hmm. where this feels more like a parent telling their life to a kid.
It almost feels like an oral tradition, which is how Moana's narration is structured. So it's kind of interesting that Disney is moving away from this dry storybook feel to a much more storyteller sort of perspective with their opening narrations.
The optimist in me says it's because they're exploring new ways of storytelling, both with animation and story structure and character structure and even filmic structure, and also therefore with narration and character interaction. The cynical part of me says it's because they're kind of ashamed of being the Disney company, so they don't want to have the whole storybook opening thing.
I mean, look at the way they lampooned that in Chicken Little.
I don't want to. I don't want to look at it. I don't. No. No. What I do want to look at, though, is the certain lack of autonomy that some of the characters have in both these narratives. Both Moana and Rapunzel live in a time and a place where things are out of joint because something is wrong. Either the princess is missing or the people have lost their way finding. And it's sort of their job to fix it. While I support characters fixing things and setting all things right, there is still a certain amount of not getting to choose how that fixing happens. Moana wants to sail, and it seems like the only way the narrative will allow that to be is if she's fixing these greater problems and restoring balance to the force, instead of just getting to sail on her own terms. Rapunzel wants to see the lanterns and explore the world a bit, and where that winds up is her becoming the princess that she was supposed to be. And while both of these things are good, and these characters seem very happy, it's interesting to me that they don't really get to choose what their destiny looks like. Both of them wind up fulfilling roles they were kind of supposed to fill, as opposed to getting to choose their own way entirely.
I would disagree in terms of Rapunzel. After Gothel turns to dust and she heals Eugene, Rapunzel's free to do whatever she wants. She chooses to go to and see her parents, and she chooses to get involved with that. She didn't have to. She could have gone off and had adventures with Eugene wherever she wanted to.
That's fair. She definitely has a longing for a home. There's nothing forcing her to go back.
And she could have easily found camaraderie with the people in the Snuggly Duckling, or even in the village just outside the castle. She did not have to choose to reconnect with her parents and become royalty, but she did so probably because she just wanted that connection.
Mm-hmm. There's one other thing with Rapunzel and autonomy that I feel kind of hinky about. So I've been going through Anna Martell's deconstruction of the Narnia series, and part of that involves talking about how the Pevensey kids don't really get a lot of choice, and when they're being dragged between the worlds, it's a little unfair that their bodily autonomy is being disrespected by these magical forces. In the same way with Rapunzel and the haircutting, it fixes some problems. It winds up allowing Rapunzel to be free of Gothel, and that's great, but it also means that this part of her that is integral to who she is and her sense of self is now gone, and that doesn't really get explored that much. While I'm not saying that Eugene was a bad person for doing that, I think it's still a bit weird that this change happens without fully getting unpacked.
I definitely agree with everything you're saying here, but we also get into the reverse about Eugene's autonomy to die so that Rapunzel doesn't have to give up her freedom to save him. So really they're at an impasse there, and one of them is going to have their autonomy to some extent taken away from them. It is kind of shitty that it's kind of de facto Rapunzel who is getting her autonomy taken away as opposed to Eugene. Well, she's the woman, so obviously her autonomy is less important. I'm not necessarily saying the film is framing it that way, but society would tend towards that. But also, on the other hand, it's Rapunzel's magic hair versus Eugene's life, and yeah, it's complicated and messy, and there's no good way to resolve that impasse.
Or at least not with only 10 minutes left of the film. Admittedly, they do seem happy afterwards, and you can make an argument that the hair was more of a curse than a gift. What do you have still?
I want to talk about the turtle.
Okay. What turtle?
The sea turtle. And I would have loved to have the turtle that Moana saves at the beginning of the film come back and help Moana in some way later on.
Oh man, that would have been really cool.
Yeah, it would have been great as, you know, Moana's kindness there being repaid and helping her along the way later. It's not a huge thing that it doesn't, but I'm a little sad. I like turtles.
Maybe like during the Sea of Monsters, it helps her out in some way, or it helps her get the heart back when she throws it into the ocean.
Or maybe it helps push the canoe while she sleeps to get to Maui, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows?
Yeah.
There are lots of options. There's also a lot of animal companions in that film already, so I get not having it. It would have definitely fit the themes that Moana's going for, and I'm a little disappointed it didn't happen.
I get you. It's not a detriment, it's just a missed opportunity.
Mm-hmm. I think it is time for the moment everyone has been waiting for.
At long last.
Our rankings of the best Disney horses. So throughout the bracket, we've talked about Disney horses. And we figured we should probably give you guys our final listing.
After copious calculations, we hired a geophysicist to make sure we had all the math right.
So this list is going to be contained to horses from films that were on our bracket, and also horses that were specifically named in the film. So Snowball, Frollo's horse from Hunchback, and Citron, Hans's horse from Frozen, are not in here because they weren't actually named in the film.
Of course, of course.
So, starting with our number 9 slot, Major from Cinderella. There's not really a whole lot to say about Major. He's just kind of this old horse that is on Cinderella's estate. He gets transformed into a footman so Cinderella can go to the ball. He's pretty cool about that. He's definitely less anxious than the mice are, but doesn't do a whole lot.
Mm-hmm. Then there's Sven, who admittedly is not a horse, but I think someone calls him a donkey at one point, so that's close enough.
He's definitely horse adjacent. Sven is probably this low ranked, partially because he kind of has Kristoff speak for him for the entire time. He doesn't show a lot of personality of his own. It's always in relation to Kristoff.
Also, not being a horse loses a few points.
Definitely.
And there's that thing with Kristoff's little outside of nature's laws.
Yeah. Then our number 7 pick is Samson, Prince Philip's horse from Sleeping Beauty. Samson gains some points for being willing to charge with Philip on his back against a dragon.
Pretty hardcore.
But loses points for running off for a voice singing in the woods when Fae are known to exist in this universe. That seems like a bad plan.
Just above is Philippe from Beauty and the Beast. Philippe is a good, strong, loyal horse who carries a weird contraption up a mountain and then manages to run all the way back home and then bring Belle all the way back up that mountain, even though there are wolves about to keep her father safe, which is pretty cool.
Also, in general, Philippe's deserve better owners. Maurice does not trust Philippe. Just above Philippe in our number 5 slot is Achilles, Phoebus's horse from Hunchback of Notre Dame. Achilles is willing to sit on a guard to make sure that Esmeralda and her compatriots are able to get away.
It took Phoebus most of the movie to get to a anti-state violence place, whereas Philippe was there from day one. Next up, we've got Khan from Mulan, who rode up an avalanche, which is really cool. Also, really good design. Like, just visually, that horse looks beautiful, and I appreciate that.
Oh, yeah. Khan definitely has a unique design compared to a lot of the other Disney horses. Also, is willing to put up with Mushu calling them a cow. Our number 3 slot is Captain from 101 Dalmatians. Part of the troop of Colonel and Sergeant Tibbs, Captain is the one who initially hears the Twilight bark call, as well as the one who incapacitates Jasper and Horace and flings them through the barn wall.
And I get the vibe that Cap is kind of on the older edge of things, but he still manages to contribute and be part of the narrative, and that's really cool.
He's also definitely the most level-headed of the, like, military brigade there.
Right.
The foundation that the Colonel and Sergeant Tibbs build upon.
Second to last is Pegasus from Hercules, who, you know, pretty cool, fought a variety of mythic beasts, and loses a few points for following a sexy horse into a dark room.
Although Pegasus is, again, one of the horses that has probably some of the most character out of all the horses on this list. Also, again, technically not a horse, is a Pegasus.
Closer to a horse than Sven.
Yes. And
well, I don't know. He's made of clouds. I'm not sure if he even has genetics. Sven probably shares some genetics with horses. Pegasus shares some genetics with a cumulative stratus.
Pegasus is also willing to go up against 5 titans and Hades and his underworld minions. Pegasus can go toe-to-toe with 2 powerful shapeshifters of pain and panic by himself.
And last on our bracket, the one you've all been waiting for, you've probably already guessed, the thoroughbred of virtue,
Maximus from Tangled. Maximus has lots of great qualities. He's great slapstick and plays off of Eugene incredibly well in the narrative. Great design, never steals the spotlight when it's unnecessary. But Maximus is also the only horse that has a character growth arc. He goes from being this unyielding arbiter of justice to realizing that the laws of the state are not always just and that he should prioritize good above law. Also, Maximus is able to wield a sword. Also, not only does he wield said sword, he beats Eugene in a duel with it. He doesn't have thumbs.
Max is very good.
So, with that out of the way, let's get to the actual main event. What wins the bracket?
I think the better music in Moana is enough to push it just a little ahead for me.
It wasn't necessarily the music that pushed it ahead for me, but I'm also casting my final vote for Moana. So, wow. Moana is, by our metrics and standards, the best Disney film. I'm not unhappy with that decision. I definitely think Moana deserves it.
Oh, yeah. Like, very clearly, it's really good. Mm-hmm. And with that, the bracket is done. We've completed our first bracket.
Yeah.
So, I know we say this every time, but what's up next week?
So, since we have not missed a Friday in 7 months, we're taking a week off. So, there'll be no new episode this coming Friday. However, after that, what you can expect is a little bit different than normal. What we'd like to do is go over the new Disney film that's coming out over Thanksgiving week, Wreck-It Ralph 2. After that, we have a couple of honorable mentions that didn't make it onto our bracket that we'll be discussing. First of which is most likely going to be Princess and the Frog. And then we have a few other episodes that'll most likely be double features. So these are going to be some of our favorite Disney films. The double features are typically going to have some common element.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll
like water or boron.
There'll probably be about 3 or 4 episodes of that. Then following that, because that should probably bring us close to the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So starting in 2019, we have a new bracket.
We'll be announcing that bracket after Wreck-It Ralph, so tune in then.
Thank you, all of our dedicated listeners who have stuck with us this long. I know we have tended to be a little long-winded. And this took quite a while, so thank you. If you would like to continue to follow us in our podcasting endeavors, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Podbean, Spotify. Since we are finally finished with your bracket, those friends that you know who love to binge through things and only want to consume them once it's completed, now's a great time to share it with them, and we would really appreciate those shares. Once again, thank you for listening to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. We hope you tune in 2 weeks from now.